Welcome. This is Sherilyn Parsons, founder and director of the Bay Area Book Festival. Enjoy the conversation.
Welcome. And I want to first thank our sponsors of this hour with Ann Beatty. Women Lit members, thank you so much for hosting this. I have some stern instructions. Please turn off your cell phones. And let's see, I think that's it. And I think we'll stop in time to open up to questions. And it says on my sheet to please advise you to ask an actual question. Okay, hi everyone, I'm Carol Edgarian, and I'm so glad to be here with all of you and with my pal, Ann Beatty, who is just magical and doesn't really need an introduction, but let me do a little of an intro just to bring all that she's done into the room. She's been a chronicler of American life for more than four decades. She's written 21 books, novels, short stories, novellas, children's book, one. But I think in all that accomplishment, something that should be said is the impact she's had on writers who've come and who follow her. You know, we writers are in conversation all the time with everyone who's come before us and everybody who's working now. And Ann really changed the possibility of short stories. And her style, her language, her ability to incorporate pathos and wit became part of the American story. And not resting... She's giving me a look. Not resting on those laurels, she keeps evolving in her work. Her work today is as dynamic and as fresh as those earlier stories, and that is an amazing accomplishment in a long career. So without saying more, let's get her voice in the room. Please welcome Ann Beatty.
Thank you, Carol.
Hey, you.
Here we go.
So, a chronicler, a harbinger of our culture for almost 50 years. Something that I think is so amazing is that year before The New Yorker took your first story, You submitted some 21 stories.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm not a mathematician, but that's roughly every 2 weeks.
Graduate school. I hated it.
So, you know, what the hell were you doing to create 21 stories? Walk us back there. What? How?
Well, I was not very suited to any graduate school program. I'm not really very interested in research. And the graduate school that I went to, it was the University of Connecticut in Storrs, had a different past. I mean, it had different teachers associated with it than those who were there then. And not to say that there weren't some good teachers, but I was really in school just so I didn't have to have a 9-to-5 job. And I had, like so many of us have had, probably even in this room or might have now, you know, a teaching assistantship that gave me at least flexible free time, even though I had to be at 8 o'clock classes probably Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and taking graduate school courses, you know, the rest of the time. And I lived in a house with a bunch of other people about half an hour, or considering how awful our cars were then, an hour and 15 minutes away from the campus. And I'm a night person also. And so I was both doing what I had to do to maintain some free time and to try to write. And writing was my hobby. And I all but failed at graduate school for every good reason. I'm not very good at that.
So were they fellow writers in the house? And did they hate you for that productivity?
Oh, no, none of the above, no. And also, I was an insomniac, so I was awake all night, and they were awake all day. So except for, it was a rented house in a little town in Connecticut, and except for a pump organ and the fact that two of the people who lived there who were incredibly stoned would decide at very odd hours that they should teach themselves how to do a whiter shade of pale on the pump organ. Da, 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 da,
pump,
da,
pump.
Da, da, da. And I think, it's 4 a.m, you know. We were all in school together, actually. One of the people in the house was majoring in psychology and later got into computers, which were very much in their early days then. Another is a good friend of mine who teaches at Harvard now. It was me, my ex-husband, and a guy who was a trapper who was so excited. He was the most excited one, and he wasn't at the university then. He was applying to get in. But he would get so excited when he saw squirrels that he would shoot out the windows. She can't believe I haven't told her this one before. She's not just faking. I guess I've never told her that one before.
I was trying to remember, has the pump organ ever appeared in a story?
No, I don't think so.
I think that's next. So what was it about that 21st story that... Do you think you wore them out, wore them down?
It's a factor. No kidding. I do think it's a factor. But what I really do think in a serious way, for all writers, including like when I taught in an MFA program, I might have been missing a lot on the first story. I mean, I might have been astute about that as an individual story, but until I understood the writer's terrain, and that took a few stories in number, if not more than that, it was very, very hard to see what they were doing as opposed to what I was projecting onto the story. And I think, in a way, I don't mean to say I came along and educated the New Yorker, it's hardly a case of that, but wore them down, but also, you know, after you've seen things 20 times, maybe by then you think, to me, 21 looks much better than 20, and this is relentless, let's give the girl a break, you know? Could be.
What do you remember about that first story?
Very little. I remember the ending of it, and I remember certainly that I wouldn't have thought, now I've written a much better story than all the others, nor was I counting. Somebody had to tell me after the fact, somebody who was researching a book, Ben Yagoda, who was researching a book on The New Yorker, is the one who first told me how many rejections I had, and I was humiliated. I mean, why wouldn't I be?
But it's instructive that, you know, putting the time in, producing the bad work or the less successful work,
right,
to get to that story, to get to the next one.
I really firmly believe you have to do it in quantity. I do. I think quantity alone will teach you something. It's true, you can get stuck in a rut and never see how to get out of it, and that could be an enormous problem. So I think there's a lot to be said for showing your work to certain astute readers. It doesn't have to be in the context of a classroom or anything like that.
Right.
But I do think getting some sort of feedback, because you're so melded with the material, it's interesting to know what an outside perspective would be. You know?
When did you tell yourself, I'm a writer? When did that become, you know, because I was... Well, if you're not...
I'm not just trying to be a smart aleck. I guess that always seemed like an aerial view of something I was doing that had such immediacy for me that I loved, that I always considered, you know, spare time activity and so exciting and something I was trying to learn as I went along, that I never really drew back and looked at it, from the sidelines and thought, oh, that person publishing yet another book and with a literary agent and on the road must be a writer.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I don't think you've ever lost that sense of play. And I think you give all of us, as your readers, that sense that you're still playing.
That would be wonderful.
Are you playing?
Yeah, sure. And I mean, this book is full of in-jokes, as all my books are full of in-jokes. And every now and then, it wouldn't happen now because I'm on book tour. And so I've been reading around in this book and I've had to sort of keep it in my mind. But, you know, if I read from this in 10 years, I'm going to crack myself up at a very inappropriate time because I'm, you know, goofing on my plumber, who I have an acrimonious relationship with. So, yeah.
Well, let's talk about the book, A Wonderful Stroke of Luck. You know right off, nobody is going to have much luck, yeah?
Yes, but I liked it because it did have a kind of ambiguity and a kind of, but what exactly does this translate into quality? And I don't think the book answers that as though it's a direct question, but I think it was helpful maybe to sort of float that as a hypothetical question. Like, is there, who would be experiencing this wonderful stroke of luck, or in what way do things go differently for people than what they expect?
Well, I love that the epigraph, that it's the Dalai Lama. Sometimes when you don't get what you want, it's a wonderful stroke of luck.
Yeah.
Where did you find that? And did you know that was going to be the title?
I was ranging around for a title. I mean, honestly, I usually think it's a really, really bad sign, even if you pick the wrong title, if you can pick no title at all, because I usually can take something out of the text, or I can even superimpose something. I mean, actually, in 1976, I published my first novel, which was called Chilly Scenes of Winter, and I had no title for that either, nor did I know it was a novel when I was working on it. But my ex-husband said, he read the manuscript and said, you should call it Chilly Scenes of Winter. And I said, why? And he said, the Cousin Emmy song. And I said, what Cousin Emmy song? So he played the Cousin Emmy song, and I said, oh, that's pretty good. Do you think that would suit? And he said, I really do. And I said, but it's nowhere in the book. And he said, just here. And, you know, I had a manual typewriter in those days. He wrote one sentence. And, you know, they crossed the room and decided to listen to the Cousin Emmy record, Chilly Scenes of Winter, thus the title. So as you can tell, this is not rocket science on my part or anybody else's. Definitely not.
I love that title.
I love it, too. It really was. You know, sometimes I've decided against a title when it's too late or whatever, and I'm sure I've missed some that were very good that I discarded too quickly. But with my short stories in The New Yorker, 95% of them were always titled by Roger Angel. And he did a great job as far as I'm concerned. Yeah, really. Good for Roger.
Good for Roger.
Very helpful.
So you had another title, and then he changed the title?
I stopped sending him in with titles. I knew he would title them beautifully. He did. He really did.
That's fantastic.
Well, he's a wonderful editor.
He's a wonderful editor and writer.
Yeah. When I was thinking about the title of this, in answer to your question, my husband is a painter, and we went out to dinner on my birthday a couple of years ago, and I still didn't have the title, and he said, this is just ridiculous, you know. Yet again, we can superimpose some title. I don't know what made him do it, but he started looking for something that had to do with luck, and the Dalai Lama popped up on his cell phone. I still remember this, you know. We were the ugly Americans with our cell phones like this under the table on my birthday. And he read this aloud, and I said, you know, that's good in a lot of levels, and one in which it's good is that I don't think they'll fight me about that title because it doesn't sound downbeat. You think about it. Think about what downbeat titles we have out there now. I'll wait.
Okay. Well, now my brain's spinning, but yeah.
Yeah. You can always find exceptions to the rules,
right.
But really, from neutral to open-ended positive is really pretty much a mandate now.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk. Do you want to read from the book just to bring it into the room?
And
do you want to do a little setup?
Yeah, I'm very bad at setups because I find books so confusing in paraphrase, including my own. But the book is the book is really in two parts, but in revising the book, they got connected. That is to say, it starts out when the main character, who's named Ben, is at a fictional boarding school in New Hampshire and surrounded by his friends and a very mercurial and maybe far worse than that, meretricious teacher who's named Pierre Laverdere. And that's the beginning of the book. And then in the early drafts of it, I had just an asterisk, and I flipped forward about 15 years, between 15 and 20 years, and picked up with Ben and some of the people he had stayed in touch with, the very few people he'd stayed in touch with from this fictional school, which is called Bailey Academy. So it is hard always to read from a novel, because a short story, whether people like it or not, beginning, middle, and end, they have a complete picture, and anything you read, obviously, is just a little excerpt. But I thought I would read from the early part when he's still at Bailey, and I think Lavradere enters into this section too. So Jasper is one of Ben's friends, and the part I'm going to read is just after Jasper's father has come to give him a ride to the drugstore to pick up some new meds he's on, and then dropped him off, disappeared, only the father to return. Then, appearing more like an apparition than a person, the man, Mr. C., Jasper's father, strode across the newly installed, historically correct carpet, that too had a nickname, View from the Roller Coaster on LSD. Mr. C. was clasping Eleanor Rule's hand. As they'd find out later, he'd driven back to Bailey, seen Eleanor, whom he recognized, though he couldn't remember her name, and asked her if she knew where the Honor Society was meeting. She'd told him and mentioned that she felt guilty for not attending. Together, they'd walked across the grass, up the stairs into the building, then entered the meeting room. Neither said anything when all conversation stopped. "Dad," Jasper said. "Yes, I am," the man said, "and I don't know where we went off course. If you wouldn't mind, Mr. Lavradere, I'm here to have a conversation with my son." "Drunk," Lulu exhaled quietly. She hadn't made her escape soon enough. Haley touched her eye patch the way she did when she was nervous. "Drunk," Mr. C. said. "Did someone say I was drunk?" Lulu looked at her boots. "Glad to see you," Lavradere said. "Jasper, your father's most welcome. We should order offer our guests some coffee. Mr. Cabot?" Lavradere's hand clasped the wrist of the other behind his back like an obsequious maitre d'. Why those guys like to look like birds hobbled by broken wings, Ben never understood. Or why Ellen, who's his stepmother, loved eating at Beaujolais, though the restaurant never seemed to be on the day she wanted or at the time she preferred. Lavradere said with a deferential nod, "Bob Cabot, isn't that right?" "Everything I've done is wrong," Mr. Cabot said. "Let me get you some coffee, Mr. Cabot. What do you take in it?" Eleanor said. She wore a scarf not nearly as fabulous as Lulu's, and red gloves lined with fur that she'd found in town, sticking up on the spikes of a fence. She had a way of finding things, but arriving with the man had been particularly unexpected. Of course, he'd actually found her. She'd mistaken the alcohol in his breath for aftershave. It never occurred to her he might have been drinking until Lulu said the word. She pulled her gloves off slowly, as if skin were liable to come loose with each finger. Then, as if he'd answered, she strode off to get a mug from the shelf. Haley's older sister, who'd also attended Bailey, had made the matching mugs. She'd also left behind painted portraits of a few of the teachers, including the tragically deceased Ms. Niffle, whose snowmobile had crashed into a tree. Mobiles made from junk pulled out of people's trash, and a large sculpted monkey with its chest ripped open, a series of hearts morphing into a small man. "Thank you," Mr. Cabot said quaveringly to Eleanor as she handed him one of the heavy mugs. "Thank you for this and for everything." His smile was really only a twist of his lips.
His smile was only a twist of his lips. I love the gloves. All the details. Where did this book start for you? What was the seed?
I suppose that although I didn't realize it in the moment that I started on this, I mean, I grew up in Washington, D.C. I'm a public school kid, and but a lot of my friends through the years have gone to private school and, you know, lived to tell. But I've been regaled with a lot of stories about those places. But even more than that, my husband and I are often asked to go speak to students at schools, and we rather like to do it. I mean, it shakes us up. It's very informative. We're not doing it directly to use it in any way. I'm surprised that I ever did. But I went to a lot of prep schools, and as you may know, and I'm assuming there are a lot of writers in the audience too, somehow when you're a writer, they're a little bit afraid of you, but it seems to me younger people are less afraid than adults who think you can read their minds sometimes, or you're going to do a number on them or something like that. So they love to give you the lowdown of what's really happening at the school. So to me, I was quite taken aback. I was both absorbing things and I was informed of a lot of things, both in the moment by these students and as I said later, by personal friends.
And where did La Verdere come from? I love that name.
No
of course,
idea.
To see, but also to be looked at, right?
Uh-huh.
The duality of that name.
Uh-huh. And maybe that it contains dare as part of it.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's totally fictional. You know, so I'm sure people realize this too, or writers often comment on it, that they'll write a character, give them a strange name, and then a week later they'll go somewhere and they'll meet someone by that name, or see that, you know, the doctor in this town is called Doctor Whatever. That kind of thing does happen. But it was totally fabricated. I also wanted to set him apart from the other teachers there. He has a really long name. He's very full of himself, to put it mildly, and I wanted him to be signaled to be other somehow. So, you know, Mr. Cabot, his name, Mr. Cabot, you can extrapolate from that, and the Cabots and the Lodges and New England and all that kind of stuff. But La Verdere, maybe Quebecois, but maybe not, you know?
So does a character like La Verdere come fully formed to you, or do you sort of begin with an aspect and then as you go on?
The latter.
Yeah.
Yeah. Something almost in the moment of composing the first draft that seems not what I had meant to put there, a line of dialogue or something like that, but then I think, well, go with it. What does this indicate? What's my subconscious telling me? And then as that starts to fill itself out, it's true, you can always rein yourself back in, but sometimes it's very interesting in terms of where the dialogue alone takes you, as opposed to you're shaping the prose of the book, I think.
Well, I think that's something that, let's go a little deeper on that, because that's something so particular to your work, that you allow yourself to discover as you go, mm-hmm. almost as if you're making the breadcrumbs as well as following them mm-hmm. as you go. So talk a little bit about that.
That's nicely said. I see why you're a writer.
But talk a little bit about that. So let's say you begin yeah. this particular book, and in that first draft, how much do you know? Do you begin at the beginning, or are you beginning at somewhere in the middle, and then you might go back and you might go forward?
I don't think I've ever done such major revisions that I ever changed a chronology. I mean, I've dropped whole things out of the book, but it tends yeah. to be more toward the middle, where I am muddled yeah. and I am confused, and then I see my way out, and I want to at least finish the draft, so I stay on that trajectory. But with La Verdere, for instance, I've written about his type before. Yeah. In fact, I handled the same character differently in a story of mine called That Last Odd Day in L.A., which was published in The New Yorker, but it doesn't interest me to just fixate on a character that I think I have the number of. I want to know in what way is that character emotionally different than the tenor of the story in which I incorporated that character earlier. I want to see what it looks like if you take you and me out of context. I mean,
right.
that automatically changes us, at least in people's perceptions.
How do you know? I mean, you've written so many stories. How do you know when the idea is a story versus a novel?
Language. It's there in my mind to be tapped into if I'm wording a story, but I just can't see the horizon line at all. I don't even know what I'm wading toward when I'm writing a novel. So it's much harder for me to see. It's much, much harder for me to do. That's not where my better skills lie. Because it, to me, anyway, even though I hope the stories work and seem somewhat realistic, no, I'm not really going for realism per se, they're an improv, but I hope that they have some kind of immediacy when I write the stories, and I think working in the short form, there are exceptions to everything, but you can maybe get a lot more immediacy. But if I get a motif going, or if I get a good line or something like that in a novel, even I think as I'm writing it, oh, that's going to get lost. I have to note to self, I have to reinforce that later, or I have to strike that line because it takes us somewhere unhelpful. It doesn't, it's just a good line. Who cares? Get rid of it right away.
So how much do you take out? It sounds like in a novel, there's a different. You have different internal rules. Yeah, is that what you're saying?
I have different internal rules and much greater anxiety.
you once said to me, I think it was very late at night. You once said something to the effect that you thought short stories were sacred versus novels.
Did I?
Yeah, you did, and it really struck me when you said it. And here we are alone, just the two of us. What did you mean?
I don't know really what I meant by that exact word. I mean, I have a great deal of respect for them too. So for me, I don't just mean it about my own stories. Sacred may overstate the case somewhat, but in other words, it's an object of emotional contemplation. And I really do think of stories that way. I almost think that so much of it is off the page, so much of it is the ripple effect, so much of it has to be done so subtly that you have to work underground so much. I think you can rise to the surface more often in novels, but personally, it interests me less. That's why in something even as minor as I can't justify it, and I'm not saying it has great literary importance, but it when I wrote that about the gloves sticking up on the fence post, I mean, we've all seen some version of that, and it's probably some good Samaritan who wanted somebody to see that, you know, the gloves were... But really, I mean, in a way, the gloves being red and pointing up and being on spikes, you think of... I mean, I'm making the gesture now, right? You know, it's also that I give up gesture, or the helpless gesture, or the what's the story behind this gesture. It's not a pleasant image as far as I'm concerned, the red gloves on the black spikes.
No, and peeling with this like skin.
And peeling like skin, yes, exactly.
No, that's not a warm fuzzy.
No, exactly, but there's a perfect example of something that I decide to reinforce, even though I don't know how, you know, surrender or physical pain or whatever is going to play out in the novel at the point at which I put it there. And believe me, if that never had anything to do with my novel, I would go back and throw the gloves in the gutter.
There's some pleasure in that, isn't there? The killing of darlings.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. Anything more you want to say about that? About let's segue a little bit. Boomers versus millennials. This book involves millennials. It takes on the impact of 9/11 on this particular group of characters. What's different about millennials and boomers? And will you spend more time with boomers?
Well, you know, when I wrote Chilly Scenes of Winter, it wouldn't have occurred to me that it would be registering the way it did as being some study of a generation. And I have to tell you, I did an interview with Lynn Neary on NPR. I was in Florida, where I live in the winter, and she was in Washington. And, you know, other than some very neutral first question, the next one was about millennials, and I thought... But I didn't see it coming. I didn't see that was going to be what people were going to reach for to categorize this novel, because to me, it had been, as Chilly Scenes of Winter was at the time in which I wrote it, more about psychology, but psychology being demonstrated rather than being brought to the surface and discussed in a more overt way. So I'm thrown off by this stuff about labels. It's not that I don't agree about certain things about millennials, But had I meant to write about millennials, the word, I'm aware of the word. I mean, it would have been in the book. And I have to tell you, even my publisher never once in any copy that I saw or in any email message to me or whatever ever said that. So I am perfectly capable of looking past the obvious. There you have it.
Well, you learn something about your book once it goes out in the world. I mean, it becomes a completely different being, right?
And of course it does. And fair enough. But, you know, I'm never sure because there's a certain level of discourse, like in the press or something, or that people are asking these questions. I almost think they're obliged to realize how things are contextualized. Whereas, you know, if I was submitting something to your magazine or something like that, I wouldn't think that would be the first thing you'd look at. I would be hard-pressed to believe that, you know. So, again, initial reactions can be informative, but they can also kind of be misleading in that there's a little cluster of people over here who are having those reactions, perhaps for rather obvious reasons, but that's not my level of interest in the book. I would have written an essay. Why wouldn't I? I mean,
What's the biggest misperception about your work from where you sit?
Sometimes that I don't have a sense of humor. I mean, I often...
Really?
Yeah, I know. Sometimes I really do see that people are looking at this as though they're looking at it very squarely indeed. And I think they miss the fact that tonally, my work to me is registering very differently. I certainly hear it very differently. I see the distinction between a character saying something wryly and saying it very sincerely. And of course, the reader does have to do the job, as we do in ordinary conversation, of sorting out what somebody's tone is. We have the advantage of reading body language and hearing somebody if we're in the room with them. We don't have that advantage in that way if we're reading a book. So I constantly am surprised that people meet me all the time and say, "My God, you just said something funny." Good.
I think you're a riot.
Thank you.
But you know, is that, we're living in unfunny times.
Well, I see that too. I understand that too. Yeah.
Do you think you're read differently today than 20, 30 years ago? That the ear is different?
No, I mean, honestly, on that level, I think I've been consistently misread, but I should also say, honestly, that, I mean, so therefore, maybe the fault is mine, who knows? But, I also think that it's been very informative to me to have gone to other writers' readings when I was much younger, and I would hear them, and even though, let's say, I liked their work to begin with, let's take the example of Donald Barthelme, who published The New Yorker to great acclaim and numerous, numerous stories before I had quite a number in The New Yorker and so forth. I saw people coming in like this, you know, to his readings and then really converted, not because he hammed it up or anything like that, but they would suddenly realize how his voice was pretty monotonal, but his delivery was good. And so it really can be an advantage to hear a writer. I mean, it can be a disadvantage too. Some people read their own work very badly. He didn't. And, you know, Raymond Carver didn't read his work very badly, I don't think. But even I, as an admirer before I went in on those occasions, really thought, oh, even I didn't get all the nuances. That's very interesting. But the other thing is, too, I'm just thinking, and then I'll shut up.
Don't shut up.
I do think a lot of the time, like when I was teaching, some of my students would say to me, I'd read a paragraph aloud, and they'd say, oh, that's really snide. I wouldn't have thought that was snide. Why? That makes sense if the character is being snide. But that's your reading of it. And I'm not a trained actress. And I said, it is my reading of it because here's why I've been cued by the writer to know that this is a snide moment. Look at everything that brackets it. Look at why it's distinct from other sentences of this kind. Look at the timing. Look at all this stuff. And I'm not saying it's easy to do, but why wouldn't you want to do that as a reader? To always be, yes, immersed in it, but also distant enough from it that you think, wait a minute, this character is stepping out of character. I mean, that seems to me that you have to have this participatory interplay between audience and writer, and why wouldn't the audience want to get in on that in any way that they can? Whereas I find a lot of times people just cross their arms and say, there she goes again. Maybe it's inevitable, I don't know.
You're a wonderful reader of your work, and we published Ann reading The Five Night Fight, and she reads it, almost sounds like she's not even taking a breath, and all of you go on to narrativemagazine.com if you want to hear her. It's 10 minutes, 15 minutes maybe, and it's just a fabulous performance.
Thank you. It's a lot of dialogue. That's easier to read than something with, you know, a lot of narrative.
So, you know, one of the things in your work is you never talk down to a reader. You assume a level of intelligence. And I've wondered, do you assume that your reader is smarter than your character? And if your characters and your readers met one another at a party, would they like each other?
Wow, I don't have any easy answer for that. Even if I'm miscalculating some of the time, I'm at least trying to err in the direction of not being so specific that it will stop people if they don't know a reference from extrapolating something. And for example, in this book, I would assume that if I were to say to people in the audience, you know, the paraphrase of the ending of Midnight Cowboy, and even if I didn't use the name Ratso Rizzo or say whatever, you know, the movie with Dustin Hoffman that ends so sadly in which, you know, he's dead on the bus or something like that. It's a pretty big clue. And yeah, if you've never seen the movie, you've never seen it. Okay, I mean, the book doesn't hang on something like that. But I wouldn't say the name of the movie because it would seem like I was dropping the name of the movie. And to varying degrees, there are all kinds of literary allusions here. I want them emotionally to be the markers I meant them to be, but if I don't paraphrase them well enough, that if you need the title of the story and you need to have read the story, I've miscalculated.
Right, and you can read on different levels.
Absolutely.
And it's got to be able to run on a level that might miss some of those things.
Exactly. I mean, I can even think of, I'm sure you know this story because we're both great admirers of Robert Stone, and he has a short story called Helping. Oh. And I always taught that story because it was interesting too, the interplay between me and the students through the years. I'd come in again and talk about what a really, really great story I thought Helping was, and still do. I'm just blown away by it. But I was teaching that, so I mean articulating things about it, having to articulate things about it rather than just deeply and quietly loving it. And I was reading something and I stopped. It was as though really, like, you know, I'd been pierced by an arrow or something. I stopped like this and I said, oh my God, it's Dickens. It was like I'd looked at the wallpaper all my life, and this whole allusion to Dickens was not apparent to me until the moment it came off the page on the 15th or 20th reading. Well, that doesn't make or destroy a story for anyone, let's hope, but I just thought, wow, I mean, that says something that I didn't pick it up in that many readings, and then I did.
Well, it's a present. It's that generosity that he certainly wrote with and that you write with of just how many gifts can you give to the reader moment to moment, page by page.
Well, he certainly gives gifts. That's really true. That's really amazing, yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, let's talk about your teaching because for so many years you taught.
I quit.
Give us, I'm totally putting you on the spot here. You're up against the wall. There is only one word of wisdom, one thing that you wanted every one of your students to know about this journey called being a writer. What is it?
Humility.
How'd that go over?
I don't know. I mean, I don't think I've ever been asked that question before. It, you know, I really try to avoid words of wisdom because they always come back to haunt you, right? Right?
Right.
Really?
Right.
It's like no good deed goes unpunished, that sort of thing. I'm afraid I do kind of believe that. But, you know, when I was teaching graduate students, for example, they were certainly a diverse bunch of people, and all of them with talent and very different talents and so forth. I taught at the University of Virginia for a number of years, and it was a two-year program, and in fiction, only 5 people a year were admitted, so even a combined class for me was 10 people, you know. And they were very different, and they were very smart, and they were very well-read, but not in what I had read, and that's the thing. I mean, if you're teaching third grade, you bully the kids into reading what you want them to read. My students certainly would largely read what I wanted them to read, but to find out what we had in common literarily so that we could talk about things that one removed from their book and say, well, so-and-so handles it this way, but as you would be the first to know, Don DeLillo handles it totally differently, blah, blah, blah. That took some getting used to on my part as well as theirs. You said it earlier, and you said it better. I mean, that literature is in dialogue with other literature. You want to show your hand, and that you know that the smart reader, even, we don't have to be a writer, that the smart reader knows that, but you're not obliged to calculate perfectly and specify everything. If you're working underground, it just has to come close enough to the surface that some percentage is going to tune into exactly what you mean, and other people maybe will tune in pretty much to what you mean. But to not see what you mean at all, then maybe you're not doing it right.
Well, also, aren't you saying about humility that your job as a writer is to know that you're coming in on this conversation that's there's so much that's come before you, and to know what's come before you.
Isn't it true? You are the worker bee. You are not the queen. You never get to be the queen. I mean, the media might say you're the queen, and that really tells
queen.
You,
don't you all think
really
she's...
tells you that you're one of the worker bees. Right. No. That's how the work gets done.
Talk about reticence.
Writerly
reticence? Just what does that word mean to you in your work? In terms of the tension in stories, in terms of that, how you posit detail after detail after detail, but there's also that moment that the characters are so flummoxed in their lives. There's a kind of reticence to act, yet they must act. It's so much of the tension in your stories. Does that word?
Well, I don't mean to be abstract about it, but I think the tension resides very much in what's under the surface. But in terms of what I put on the page, you know, I'm doing a trick of distraction. In other words, if I already know the reticence of the character, and if I'm interested in that character psychologically, I'm going to try to mimic for the reader exactly what the character is aware of and always resisting. So in other words, I could say a lot about the flowers, the water, the lighting, the rug, the shoes I chose to wear. You know, obviously that's not to the point. That's not who we are. That doesn't have anything to do with anything. But in the moment, I might very much be thinking, what a nice bunch of flowers between me and Carol, and here we are, and here's this rug, and if you look at it for too long, it's almost like the rug that I wrote about here, and so on and so forth. But in other words, I have to put the distraction that the character is encountering there in the text of the story, and one way to do that is to overwhelm them with detail, not just the reader, so that finally the detail has to be renounced.
Right.
Or expounded upon, or something has to change with it.
You know, the role of the outsider, you know, a writer always being on the outside. Do you know any writers who think of themselves as insiders? By definition, are we all outsiders?
Think of themselves. I think writers do, to some extent, want to belong to a group, and I sympathize with that because it is a very lonely activity. It really is a lonely activity. So through time, I can see that kind of yearning, but I'm afraid I almost just see the commercial,
right,
you know, implications of something like insider or outsider. I mean, we all want to think we're, you know, cool and rebellious and the fly on the wall, you know, but the fly has keener eyes, irises than we do, and can see, you know, multifariously and all that kind of stuff. It sounds good, but I don't know. I mean, I think you have to be enough of an insider to survive, whether you want to call yourself an insider or not.
Yeah. You once said you distrusted ideas.
Well, we must have some talks late at night, I'm telling you.
You didn't say it to me.
No.
I found that somewhere.
Oh.
And I thought that, first of all, I didn't think that sounded like you, but I thought it was interesting, so I'd put you on the spot here and ask you that. What you don't remember saying it? Maybe it was ideas and stories, that a story doesn't come to you as an idea.
Yeah, nothing comes to me in paraphrase, or some writers work differently. I don't think people's writing methods matter so much, although they are of interest to me. I'm certainly interested if I meet a writer and sometimes, you know, just have out with the question or something like that. How many times did you revise this, you know? And often get very, very surprising and humbling answers about those things, too. I don't know. I mean, I don't work abstractly. I don't know the end of a story until the story seems to put itself there for me and the characters start speaking in ways that are surprising to me and a little bit out of my control. I don't trust that I'm even getting into any deeper groove. So I kind of like, in a way, my own vulnerability. At the same time, it's pretty frustrating.
How much do you throw out? I mean, how often do you throw a story out?
More than 50% of the time.
Wow.
60, 65, 70.
Do you go, I love that William Trevor would work on a story for 10 years. He would write a draft, stick it in a drawer. I have this image of his desk, you know, a desk with, you know, 30 drawers. Oh, this is drawer number 15. I think it's time for that story to have another go. But he would do a draft, put it away, do a draft. So do you ever go back and say, oh, that one?
Almost never. Really, almost never. Only in the most minor ways, really, to take something I researched. Like I had a story once called The Confidence Decoy, and I had really researched decoy making, and I couldn't make it work. I never made it work, but I used it almost as a little throwaway in a different story that I wrote, you know, and planted that. But that's objective information. I mean, I just liked it, and I liked the way I could use it metaphorically, and I was glad it was filed away there in my brain. I don't usually have things that are that expedient that I can just pop into something.
Do you keep notebooks, or is it all... Do you keep notebooks, or is it all up here?
No, I don't keep any notes at all. I wouldn't trust them. I mean, then it would seem some version already existed, and I guess I do have some sort of odd mystical belief that what pops into your mind at the moment may not be right, but it's in service of a first draft. We're only talking first drafts. A lot of things change.
Right, of course.
Of course, you know.
So iconic characters, you know, Mrs. Nixon, Cher, Elvis, I mean, it goes on and on. Who's next up? any man with orange hair?
I never know till I start writing. Really, that's the thing. I don't, I don't realize until I need something and reach for it in the moment that I've even retained a visual image about something. And again, then the question is not just, oh, that's kind of interesting. It's like seeing a photograph I didn't know I'd taken and being sort of surprised by it. You know, if you're scrolling through your cell phone, you think, oh, I never knew that I got that picture of the Christmas tree or something like that. And then you kind of look at it. It's not the same because you need your Christmas tree with a different resonance for fiction. But if you have the fact of a Christmas tree at all, you can put it in there and then you can transform it. And I wouldn't want it there not transformed. I'm perfectly happy if I say to my husband, wow, it's the prettiest tree I've seen all year. That's it. It's a wrap. I don't need to write a story about that. You know what I mean?
What would Lincoln say? So to Anne's husband, Lincoln.
He'd think I was unusually cheerful that day, wouldn't he?
Yeah. He'd
think, good, honey, you must be feeling better today. Yeah.
Are there any subjects you're done with? Kind of been there, done that.
You know, I have something invested in not being able to categorize the subjects probably as well as somebody more objective could categorize. And if somebody did that and called it to my attention in a way that brought me up short, I would certainly listen carefully. But I think I need to have this illusion that I'm always in new territory. And it's not new just because it's uncertain. But, you know, that's the distinction for me, making it unique, or here I am yet again revisiting as La Verdere, somebody that I previously, you know, had as a main character in a short story of mine 10 years ago.
Are there characters that are off limits?
Sure. I mean, real people are very interesting to me as real people, but I wouldn't know where to go with them particularly unless I automatically melded a couple together, fictionalized, and then put them in a context in which I wouldn't know them as well as I felt or as I had the illusion I knew them in real life. You know, it's not that I think my friends are limited, but they would have limited use for me fictionally if I were only to stick to what I think are the facts of the case. It would just be, what would it be for me, but anecdotal? I don't know.
So you're going to be on Seth Meyers. What's the date?
May 20th. I've never been on TV before. Has anybody out there been on TV before? Would anybody out there like to be on TV? I'm with you. It's very nice of him and very unusual. It's so-called literary fiction. I mean, I know he does cover books and he is serious and I watched his show, but I couldn't have been more surprised when he said that he wanted to do this book. Really, totally surprised.
Oh, he'll do a great job. But, you know, to your point of perky titles,
mm-hmm.
Do you feel you have to be perky?
Hope not.
There's a sense in your work of, and way before this time, when I think we're all in agreement that things are a bit dire. But you seem to have sort of put out that call early on that we're sort of your characters don't get what they want,
mm-hmm.
and they're confused.
Mm-hmm.
Is that because that is dramatically interesting to you, or is how much of that is just the way you see the world?
Oh, I suspect primarily the latter. I mean, that is what I would think about that. But, you know, you want to be on guard as a writer about superimposing your own beliefs on a series of characters, too. So I'm aware of that. I mean, I'm guarded about that.
You know, there's one of my favorite stories that we published is The Caterer.
Yeah.
And how many of you, I can't really see you out there.
But no, it's
how
hard.
Many
you
of
do this,
read,
you can see better.
So it's a perfect story. And it's a story that's got so many elements into it. And I'm going to forget half of them, but the main character's a caterer. She's got a daughter. The daughter's got a boyfriend. They're late for the catering job. They get to the job, which is a Bernie Madoff party where they're going to burn him in effigy. And the wife is completely checked out from the husband, who's enraged and has got a Bernie fixation. She's upstairs getting dressed with headphones on. He has a heart attack. And
I love that story.
In her closet, and the caterer's got to come up and tell her, your husband's, you know, dying downstairs with a heart attack. And she's like, really? I'm getting dressed, you know. And it, you know, most people would stop there. But in her closet, a woman is hiding. And we don't really know why she's hiding. And the caterer... Anyway, I'm doing a ridiculous plot summary, and it's
it's worth so much more. But
that story did occur to me incrementally. I mean, I couldn't have been more surprised, really, when she went upstairs, that it was not only, you know, as you hope the reader would identify with every character, in effect, the guy having a heart attack, the wife finding out he's having a heart attack, the person who has to bring the news, who needs any more? But the fact that there is somebody there who doesn't seem to speak English and who just is like running and hiding in the closet, who later pops out of the closet with a pair of shoes.
But she's also the giver of gifts.
Oh, yes, yes, that's true.
I mean, she's the redemption. She's the god of the story in some ways.
But don't you understand, sort of, as you're reading it, that she just doesn't have her papers, she doesn't have a green card, she's working there, she shouldn't be there. What does she know to do but to physically hide from the messenger?
No, I think she's the wisdom of the story in an odd way, right?
Yes. And she knows to give a gift, you're right. She gives her the lady of the house's shoes.
But it's a classic, it's one of your classics. I mean, there are so many, but you know, it ends, believe it or not, with a cat bringing her a dead mouse, and that's Grace.
Oh, that's a great reading. I never thought about it that way. That is a great reading.
But only you could have pulled, you know, leaving us with a dead mouse, and it's...
We hope it's a radiant dead mouse.
A radiant dead mouse.
Yes. You know, I did this. I have a good friend in Maine where I live in the summer, and she for many, many years was a caterer. And she let me come and cater with her so I could listen and so I could watch and see what went on. It was pretty interesting. Really, I wore my black pants, my white shirt, my flats, and... Would you like a mini quiche? It contains organic wheat flour, almond milk, and soy protein.
Did you say it with that tone?
Probably. I don't think I was very good at the job, but I did it repeatedly. Much to her amusement, she says, see, this is what people sound like. You want to know what people sound like? Did you hear that conversation? I can see from your expression you did, huh? Get those quiches out there. Get those quiches out there. Yeah.
Well, we're about to open this up for questions, but one thing I just want to circle back, because you're a Canadian goose in a way. You start out summers in Maine, you sort of fly down to Virginia, then you spend winters in Key West, and then you guys do the loop back again, and place is such an element of your work. But you're also, you're displaced, and you write about that.
Yeah. Well, I'm obviously bringing it on myself, right?
Well, are you, or does that give you energy?
Nothing really feels like home. Nothing feels inevitable. I don't mean that I don't feel, you know, happy with my husband wherever we're living or something like that. But I mean, it's not as though I grew up in D.C. I don't feel anything emotionally about Washington, D.C. at all, and didn't even really feel it when I was living there. And I went to undergraduate school there, too. You know, in New York City, I mean, I live there. It seems both the same, of course, and very changed when I go back there. But I don't really feel that I totally fit in anywhere. I don't feel sorry for myself. I mean, obviously, that's what I've chosen. But it goes along with another one of my, you know, beliefs that you will know very well, which is that writers will do anything in order to avoid writing. I really do. I'm catering in the summer. I mean, I should be writing. I understand that. I see where my agent gets mad at me. But, you know, I think sometimes if you can't shake it up enough internally, shake it up externally.
Let's take a few questions. All right, how does this work? I think in my list of instructions, there's going to be somebody. We have a mic in the audience, okay.
Oh, this is nicer. We can see
you. Hi, everybody.
Hi.
Can I just...
Wait for the mic, please.
This is embarrassing, but the first question is actually for Carol.
Yes.
You have an online magazine narrative, and you publish wonderful works of Anne's. You also publish work of emerging writers. And so for the new and emerging writers here, I'm just wondering what the word counts would be. And I know you have an online submission form, but is it possible to send it to someone directly like yourself or an editor?
So narrative is a digital platform for publishing, and we publish some 300 writers a year, a third of whom are emerging. So we're always looking for new talent, and part of what our mission is, we're a nonprofit, part of what our mission is to bring forward new works. So, but digital is the key word there. You have to submit digitally. And there's, if you go on the homepage, there's a guidelines, there's a submit pull down menu. And we're one of the biggest publishers of poetry. So we publish poetry, we publish 6-word stories, we publish 150 word stories, short shorts, novel excerpts, novels, and certainly a lot of short stories. So in terms of word count, look at all the different categories. And something I'm really proud of, I mean, when you said, can you submit directly to an editor, know that you're going to be read really well and by more than one person. And something behind the scenes, and I really feel this about publishing, and we've talked a lot about this. There are good folks behind the scenes who are really rooting for you. And trust that. I can't see. Is there? Can you see?
Anne,
you
go.
Yeah. Oh, there.
Okay. He's coming.
Question for Anne. Thank you for all your brilliance. I was wondering,
thanks.
I'm worrying about your first 20 rejections, and I'm just curious if those eventually, you decided any of them were worth publishing, I mean, someone decided for you, or were those first pancakes that you felt were just process leading up to that first published story?
Yes, some of them were published in small magazines. They were, I published very early on in a magazine called Western Humanities Review, for example. There were other magazines at the time that aren't around any longer, Fiction International, things like that. Some of them were published. And then finally, when I was bringing out my first book of stories, which also came out in 1976, they certainly let me make the cut. I mean, they cared so little. But there were 19 stories in that. So I think a lot of them that were not previously published also made it into the book. Not all of them, by any means. And certainly even I had my favorites and had to pick among them. But, you know, it's interesting. I mean, even my last story collection, which came out a couple of years ago, they really let me make the selection of that too, so that book could have gone in several different directions, and there are plenty of them sitting around still that are, I don't know if they'll ever be published now. I mean, it used to be really that I would have stories come out in magazines, and then after I had a certain number of stories, they would do a book. But now they don't want to do a book of stories unless it's a themed collection, and I certainly don't want the inhibition of a theme in the back of my mind as I'm trying to write, so that's not very likely to happen. I mean, I did stumble into it. I wrote a book a few years ago that was called Maine Stories, and they were all based, nominally they're based, you know, in the state of Maine, and there's one character who appears in the beginning story, the middle story, and the last story, but no one else is in her orbit. They're not related in the sense of conventionally related short stories. But, you know, everything's concept now, and again, it's not the motivating factor of how I work, and so I would probably have to have a great number of things until I could superimpose some theme on them and ever get a book out, is my feeling.
I see a hand here.
Hi,
Okay, sorry. Hi, Anne. I'm a huge fan of your work. I'm just wondering which writers have had the greatest influence on you now and also in your past work, and who are you currently reading?
Well, who I'm currently reading? I read the new poetry book by Terence Hayes called American Elegies for My Past and Future Assassins, I think it was. Thought that was absolutely wonderful, really brilliant. And the novel that I've read most recently that really made an impression on me is Dave Eggers' book, The Parade. In fact, I mean, for me at least, I don't say this just loosely, I think it's a perfect book, perfect. So I'm really in awe of that, and it's very moving and very influenced by many things, including Beckett, and it just sort of does a wonderful warp on dystopian literature that now, you know, has to like top itself at its own game. But this pulls back from that in a way and goes back to Beckett and other things that I thought it was. I asked a friend for his email and sent him a fan letter. That's how much I liked it. I should do that more often. Who's been the most influential on me? I started writing so early that I started publishing so early, like in, I think I was 24 or something like that, 25 maybe, when I was publishing in the New Yorker, and I was fairly prolific. I have to say that I was in graduate school in those days, and I didn't read a lot of other contemporary writers, so if anything, I feel kind of grateful that there were fabulous writers writing then that whose work I still follow now, Joy Williams, Stephen Milhauser, absolutely, Deborah Eisenberg. I mean, they were writing in those days and so forth. It was more, I think, that they gave me courage and I felt bolstered by them rather than that I thought, oh, I can write a Deborah Eisenberg sentence, because I'm here to tell you she's a genius and I really couldn't write a Deborah Eisenberg sentence, even if you put me in a dark room with one spotlight for the next 24 hours. Can't be done unless you're Deborah Eisenberg. But now I think it really is that I look at people and I do sometimes admire their technical brilliance, but it doesn't necessarily have anything there that I can take away from it, whereas something that could be not great literature might be something that technically I think, why didn't I think of that? That's interesting. It's an interesting way to bracket a book or something like that. And again, I don't start with an abstract and work toward the specific. I start with some specific, a visual specific, and then kind of expand outward. And nothing's to be learned by that, but that, you know, writers write differently, but that's the way I write. It's wonderful writers. I mean, there's so many wonderful writers writing now. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, well, how about, we have time, for, I think, for two more questions.
Okay. My question is, I think in almost all writing today, politics comes into writing, identity politics, women's stories, gay rights politics, different minority groups, social justice issues. I wonder if you can comment on that, and how do you think your writing plays into that kind of literary turn?
You mean, do I think that it's a necessary, just that there is a lot of it, or do I think it's a necessary component of what people are writing? I think sadly, we're all kind of overwhelmed a lot of the time, and maybe are just inherently reaching for that more than we did in the past, somewhat. But, I mean, if you're asking me to say whether I think that that needs to be something that factors into writing, I wouldn't be comfortable with making that kind of a generalization. There's a really, really, I wish I could remember who wrote it. I read it in the plane yesterday. It's in the May issue of Harper's Magazine. And there's an essay, really, about just this topic that is very, very good. Get the May issue and look at the discussion of how politics is, you know, infusing everything that we write because of our huge preoccupation with it as a culture and because of this unique moment and so forth. I mean, I think writers can and should take any stand they want to take in any genre they want to take it, but as to whether something is deficient because it doesn't overtly have that there, again, that wouldn't be a criterion of my own. What about you? What do you think?
Yeah, I think you serve the story. You serve the art. You don't superimpose, you know, an agenda. If it feels superimposed, it's a flaw in the piece.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what I think.
But you can't live in a vacuum either.
Right.
Right. And it's a brave new world out there, and it's a world where, you know, we're busting down enough walls to get more people, different kinds of voices that we've so badly needed to hear for so long are finally getting heard, and bravo.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay, last question.
Sorry. My question is, there's been talk about the demise of the book, that people don't read books anymore. We have a president who's proud of that. This festival would belie that, and obviously your proliferate work output would belie that. What is your opinion, Anne, about that as a comment on our society, or do you have an opinion on that? I'm just interested. Thank you.
Well, my opinion, I mean, don't we all just feel we have to fight the good fight? I mean, doesn't that go without saying, really? I do think that's true. And it seems to me as simple as that. I am very discouraged, as I'm sure anyone would be, if you look at the Authors Guild survey about the book business, which you can look at online. You don't have to be a member of the Authors Guild to get their information. It is really shocking to find out that from the, you know, annual income of the average writer, and what does that mean? That means me, Carol, John Grisham, 10 people we're not aware of today as we sit here, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Nevertheless, they're doing what we're doing. To think that it's down 37% in the last 2 or 3 years, the problem here is that nobody ever went into, well, individuals may have done it and individuals may have accomplished it. Nobody's going into this to make a million, really, at the level of writing like poetry and serious literature and so forth. But there are not even enough sustaining jobs in a related field for writers coming out of these millions of MFA programs now. And, you know, things are very grim. It's an open question, but I think it answers itself in terms of what, forget supporting writers, what about militantly not supporting writers? Because the problem is that the publishers can't afford to give the advances they used to give. And as we all know, many people got what they got. You know, the advance against royalties, they never made back the advance. But the publishers were loyal and stayed with them and gave them a forum, and maybe the third book would click, or maybe that person would go to medical school, or who knows what happens. But it's really grim now in terms of, I don't think it's that people aren't reading. I think it's that a large part of it is that people are not being given a living wage, and they're going to internalize that. And there's the risk that very, very talented people will turn away from the profession. But Carol should answer that too, because you see things slightly differently too than I do on the inside, right? I mean,
well, I think the economics are grim.
Yeah.
But I also think, to your point, that we're so hungry for story, for some kind of connection that the news can't provide. That is the connection between what happened and our humanity, and that's what art does. It brings us back to our hearts, right? And I think what I'm seeing both behind the scenes in terms of seeing work that's coming in, and also when I go around talking to people, I think there's such an urgency and such a hunger
to be told a story that is that has some other element than the news of the day that is so grim and that fights it. So I think that's what this festival proves so much, is that we're here for connection.
And I hate to be told I live in a bubble. Does anybody think this is really analogous to a bubble? I mean, look around you. There's no bubble.
So I think we have to stop. Thank you, Anne. Thank you for being such a good audience.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast from the Bay Area Book Festival. For more information and podcasts, please go to www.baybookfest.org.